Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
According to reports, Kevin Durant flew to New York for an MRI yesterday. The expectation is the MRI is going to reveal an Achilles tear. The expectation also is Golden State will announce that news later on today. So far, nothing official. And while that's going on, another story keeps going as well, and that is, who are you going to blame for that injury? Actually, the scope of the injury was not even known before Hot Take Nation came flying in to blame the Warriors organization or the medical staff or some combination of the two. Twitter gangsters, the tough guys behind a keyboard, have now been replaced by Twitter doctors who did not even go to the trouble of printing off a fake medical degree to slap on their wall before they start to speculate furiously about medical details that we don't know and probably never will. And don't get me wrong, there are actual doctors who have Twitter accounts who can provide useful information about injuries. But even those observations are based on watching video off a phone or a computer from thousands of miles away. However, a lot of the alleged Twitter doctors are claiming that they know something that the Warriors and even Durant himself either didn't know or tried to hide. Or that the Warriors and the media pressured him to play by talking about how the Warriors might be better off without him. And how some of his teammates were frustrated that he had not come back sooner. And that nobody knew if he was coming back at all. All of which would suggest that Kevin Durant, a two-time Finals MVP, was not trying to get back on the floor in time for the NBA Finals. That one of the most competitive guys ever, was saying to himself, for who? For what? For who? For what? And that the team, knowing that, had to convince him to play. Or even worse, trick him into playing. Or bully him into playing. I mean, that's what you'd have me believe. That's what you're trying to argue. Yeah, well, that doesn't work for me. And as I said yesterday, if he doesn't play in the NBA Finals and Golden State ends up losing in five games, what kind of heat would that guy be taking right now for not even trying? And how much of that heat would be coming from the same idiots ripping the team for allowing him to play or encouraging him to play? You know, the same people who are rushing in to claim that he got screwed would be the very same people and the first to question his competitiveness, his desire. These same people would be challenging his toughness and his heart, his willingness to lay his body on the line and be a good teammate. They'd be spewing garbage like, see, he never really was a Warrior. He was just gravy training them to a couple of rings and then bouncing for something else. A real competitor would have gone out there and would have risked his body for another ring. So everybody who's claiming to be on Team KD right now, by blaming the team or the doctors for his injury after he did play, would have had an extremely high tolerance for that same pain if he didn't play. And now that same crowd is saying that Golden State pushed him back out there and pressured him to play, or they should have held him back and protected him from himself. Yeah, well, unlike all these Twitter MDs who have no idea what the hell they're talking about, NFLer Richard Sherman, who is no stranger to an Achilles injury, does know what he's talking about. And he took to Twitter to share his thoughts on the topic. Quote, "It really frustrates me listening to current and former players act like anyone could have kept KD from playing last night. Every single athlete worth their weight dreams of playing in the championship game of their sport, and most of us are making that same decision. Hashtag stop the BS. Listen, I don't know what really went down. I don't know everything that happened. I don't know what the team told him or didn't tell him, but what Sherman says makes a hell of a lot of sense. That was not some midweek game in January. That was game five of the NBA Finals. Those are the moments that a competitor like Kevin Durant would live for. This guy loves the game of basketball. He loves competing. He loves winning. He's in it to stack titles. Of course, the guy wants to be out there and would do anything to be out there, and especially to be there for his teammates. You know, the same guys that so many of these idiots say that he doesn't care about. That's pretty rich. Killing a guy for not caring enough about his teammates, even though you've never spent a single second around any of them or spoken to any of them. But back to Sherm, because he was not done. Sherman said, quote, "We fully know our bodies and what we are risking, especially at the professional level. I am sure there were attempts to persuade him to continue to wait. He's built different than the people saying that he shouldn't have played. Maybe that's why they haven't gotten where he is." Sherman continued, quote, "Respect the man's heart and sacrifice. Appreciate what he tried to do for his team." At KD Trey 5, "Keep your head up, brother. Takes a warrior to go out there knowing what you knew. Hashtag respect comes from someone who knows personally how that felt." End quote. Nothing but respect for Durant and for Sherman for spelling it out like that. Listen, I get this. I understand. The situation sucks. It's awful to watch anybody get hurt, especially that guy suffering that injury in that moment. It really sucks to see him get hurt and to know that he may go an entire year without playing again. But at the same time, all of you riding him right now, all of you claiming to have his back and repping him so hard, what are you so upset about? You're not the one who's going to need surgery. You're not the one who's going to probably miss an entire year. You're not the one having to do the painful, lonely rehab. So why the hell are you getting so worked up? None of this happened to you. So we can argue whether or not Durant should have been out there, although Richard Sherman would argue that any world-class athlete worth his weight would have been out there. We can argue whether or not he should have been out there. Just don't go looking to blame one person or one entity for him doing it, because you can't. There was a set of circumstances and a confluence of events that put that guy on the floor. Oh, and one more thing. He wanted to be there. At the end of the day, if he did not want to be out there, he would not have been out there. They can clear him to play, but they can't make him play. Maybe this guy took all the information that he was given, considered all the risks involved, and ultimately decided, let's do this. I'm ready. Yes, he gambled. Yes, he ultimately crapped out. Yes, it sucks. But so does blaming the GM or the coach or the organization for it happening, because there is plenty of blame to go around. Or finally, really, maybe none at all. Maybe it's a world-class athlete doing what world-class athletes do, whatever they possibly can to get back in the fight and try to win a world championship. And I respect the hell out of the guy for giving it a shot. And that should end all the questions about his competitiveness, whether or not he loves his teammates, and if he was doing everything he could to get back and rejoin the fight. Because clearly he was. And he was out there because he wanted to be. Again, I'm not saying the team handled that perfectly. I'm saying that the team, that team, would not have misled or tricked a guy like that into playing because they were on the verge of losing the series and they knew that he was going to bounce this summer. That's what I'm saying. I can't say they would do that. And unless you were in the facility for all those discussions and meeting with the team doctors yourself, instead of pretending to be one on Twitter, you can't say that either. Adam Jones is my guest. Adam, it has been a long time since you and I spoke. How you doing, man? How's life?
Oh, man. When I got your request, I was like, oh, I got to talk to Rome. It's been some years, brother. How you been?
My man. So good. I'm really good. It's really good to hear your voice. How are things for you?
Hey, it's been amazing. I got a job, so I can't be mad. Still fortunate enough to play Major League Baseball and with a great group of guys over here in Arizona and trying to grind to get to this postseason just like everybody else.
All right, so I know you want to be there, and I want to get into the Diamondbacks in 1 minute, but I read that part of your resume off the very top. Again, you're putting up big numbers. I would argue that putting up numbers and being a leader was never going to be in doubt for you. Is there any part of you, however, that wants to say to all the teams that could have signed you, Adam, how do you like me now? This is what I was trying to say.
In a way, I think everybody obviously is going to look at it like that no matter what. But to me, I'm just out here doing what I just normally do. I believe that if I'm healthy, I'm going to get in that batter's box instead of, stepping on this field and contribute in some sort of way, which I have done for the last 12 years. So I'm just trying to grind it out, really. I'm not trying to say, stick it to nobody or this is, whatever to you. I'm just worried about myself. and trying to be the best teammate I could be and playing the game. And, you know, at the end of the day, I always said, I'm going to get mine somehow. So just got to stay healthy and get in that box to produce. So it's not an animosity thing towards anybody, because that's just bad energy that I don't need, and I don't need to carry that kind of stuff in my heart.
Are you doing a repair that needs a special tool? O'Reilly Auto Parts makes it easy with our loaner tool program. Over 80 specialized loaner tools are available, so we're sure to have a tool in stock to help you get that job done right. Purchase the needed parts, put down a deposit on the loaner tool, return that tool in its original condition, and then receive a full refund. It is that easy. O'Reilly Auto parts, better prices every day. Diamondbacks right fielder Adam Jones joining us. I get that. Niatori Lovello on the program earlier this year. We talked about how much he appreciates you. What's it been like to play for Torrey?
It's been amazing. I appreciate him too. I mean, obviously he's different than Buck, you know, but he uses his coaches like Buck. He's very player oriented. He wants to know what's going on, how you doing, how you feeling, how's the body. They're big into, you know, giving you guys rest, and you know, it's been like uncomfortably cool, because obviously I don't ever want a day off. But you know, when you get it and you realize that, you know, you're fresher the next day, or you might get in the game in the late because there's no such thing as a day off in the National League. So, but you just feel a little bit fresher, and I found that out so far. And you know, I feel really good. My body feels good. And you know, I think I owe that to Torrey and the training staff and the coaches for, you know, trying to just structure the workload at early in the season, because once the second half of the season starts, August, September, it's go time, because, you know, games are very, very important.
We're talking to Adam Jones, Arizona Diamondbacks right fielder, is joining us. And Adam, last season was a challenging year in that you were playing for a team that won only 47 games and finished 61 out. I just bring it up because as a competitor, what was that entire experience like for you?
As a competitor, everybody on that team will tell you it was a challenge every single day. But I've always said this, and I've been adamant about it, that it was unreal and awesome going to work every day with those guys, though. It just sucked at the end of the day. The result was never in our favor. But it didn't make, like, going to the ballpark every day was awesome for me. But it's just the result just sucked on a nightly basis. But it wasn't for a lack of effort. It just nothing worked out. And, you know, I loved all the guys. I mean, like I said, it was great going to work with those guys. Just nothing worked out. nothing worked out. We just had collectively, you know, because it's a team game. It doesn't matter what individuals do. As a team game, you know, not many people had a good year on the team. And It wasn't from a lack of effort. It was just, I can't point a finger on it. I don't think anybody can point a finger on what happened. It's just, we just weren't that good. But it wasn't from a lack of effort, and the guys were tremendous.
It's just one of those years. Adam Jones joining us. Now, you recently run CC Sabathia's podcast, and you've been at this thing a long time. He's been at this thing a long time. You've gone up against him for years. You have 108 plate appearances against him. What's it been like to face him over the course of your career?
I mean, it's been an absolute pleasure, obviously, because I played against him, known about him since I was in high school. And, you know, being able to play against him, he's a future Hall of Famer. It's just humbling, the fact that, you know, we're each other's most competed on duo. Like, I've faced him the most and he's faced me the most. So, like, that's like really, really cool to me, because you know, there's a lot of guys that have faced him a lot. There's a lot of guys that he has history with, and he's been around a long, long time. So it's just been awesome. It's been great to see, obviously, the transformation. I remember, like, you know, when his knees started bothering him in 15, and you know, everybody started to write him off and all that stuff, and he signed another extension and still, you know, still a sub-4 ERA. And, you know, he went from playing checkers, and when he was 95 to 98, to playing chess, because right now he's, you know, 88 to 91. You know, he can hump up and get 92, 93 every once in a while. He knows that, but now he's playing chess, and, you know, he's still doing really well. You know, when that knee ain't barking, he's still out there giving quality innings for the Yankees. So it's just amazing to see the transformation, because a lot of people, especially power pitchers, it's real hard for power pitchers to make that transformation into finesse, and he's made it really well.
Adam Jones is joining us. You mentioned high school. Now, there's this great story from back in the day when you were growing up in San Diego. A white Porsche pulls up alongside. What do you remember about that, and what was your reaction when you saw the car and who was in it?
Well, I mean, it was a white Porsche in the hood of San Diego. You know, only two kind of people drive a white Porsche in the hood of San Diego. So when TG got out of that car, we sat on the hood. We were playing a game. That's, you know, and everybody just stopped a little bit, just turned and started looking back. And then you just hear the whispers, the rumblings in the dugout, like, hey, who's that? Is that Tony Gwynn? Is that TG? Is that TG out there, man? And, you know, we all just, it seemed like everybody hit a switch and just started playing that much harder for Tony. And, you know, I think that's the day, not just for me, the team that we were playing, my teammates, the families that were there. It wasn't just my experience of it. It was probably 70, 80 people's experience. It's just, you know, obviously I've got to know them the best out of those folks. But it was just once in a lifetime thing that, you know, I'm Tony Gwynn's first recruit ever for San Diego State, and that's something that will always be with me.
What was that like, Adam?
Amazing. I mean, me being able to talk to him telling me, you know, these are what things you can improve, things that he could help me with. And it's Tony Gwynn. I watched him, you know, the second I started watching baseball, you know, Tony Gwynn is Mr. San Diego. And, you know, obviously getting to know him past getting drafted, I just obviously didn't go to college, but getting to know him until he passed. Every offseason I hit with him at San Diego State, and every offseason he gave me that much more information. And I think that's what's helped me sustain being here for you know, going into my 13th year now. You know, just the advice from good people that I've had in my corner when it came to the sport. So, and he's one of the biggest vital guys in that. Him and Mark McElmoy, the two guys that have basically mapped out how the career goes. So I'm indebted to those guys.
So Adam, finally, in terms of how the career goes, I mean, you're in this thing for a long time, 13 years, 14 years. The number of guys who make it to the majors is tiny. The number of guys who play as long as you have is infinitesimal. As somebody who loves the history of the game, how much pride is there for you in how long you've played and the fact that you're still playing at a really high level?
I mean, it's unbelievable. I did an interview with Hazel May the other day, and they said, I think one thing that's helped me, and it's helped a lot of guys too, is when you wake up in the morning, you realize you're a major leaguer. Obviously, as you've seen the last few years, that, you know, with options going up and down, there's a lot of people making their debuts, but get 50 at bats, get sitting down and back and forth. But being able to just stay here, sustain being here for this long, is attests to a bunch of things. First off, it's health. You know, I've been blessed to be a pretty healthy guy throughout my career, and I've had two people, my strength trainer in San Diego and my massage therapist. Those two, the last decade, have put their hands on my body and hurt my body, but has made me able to go out on this field. So them, the training staff throughout the years, it's a culmination of things. But every day I wake up like, hey, I'm a major league player, and I have a major league mindset. And I think that has helped me just be here, and it's a humbling experience. And it's great to be able to pass along information to these young guys. I know I'm only 33. Okay, Jason Wirth got a 7-year contract at 32. But, I'm looked at as one of the older guys, but it's great to be able to pass information. And, you know, just seeing Vladdy Guerrero Jr., against his dad, robbed home runs from his dad, like, and now he's in the big league. So it's just to see the turnover, that's the – CC told me that. That's the craziest part, when you feel like, dang, I have been here a long time.
You want my take on the really big things in sports and pop culture. All right. That said, this is also a big, big soccer house. You know that too. I want you, or I know you, all desperately want me to talk about what went down yesterday in World Cup group play. I know you need it. I know you want it. I know you've been waiting for 2 hours for me to talk about that 13-0 historical wax job that the U.S. women put on Thailand yesterday. You've been waiting on that, haven't you? Good news is, you no longer have to wait. Here it is. I will talk about that. I want to talk about that. In fact, I could not wait for the alarm to go off this morning so I could roll out of the rack, crack open the mic, just to talk about that. For those of you who missed it, the defending World Cup champion U.S. Women's National Team beat the living hell out of Thailand yesterday. 13-0. No, I did not misspeak. No, that is not an error. No, that is not an Onion headline. That is not a joke. The baddest soccer players on the planet straight murdered Thailand by a score of 13-0. Alex Morgan went off. She scored 5 of the 13 goals. Now, if 13-0 sounds ludicrous and unheard of, it's because it is. It had never been done before until now, until the U.S. put their cleats on Thailand's throats and did not let up until stoppage time was over in the 93rd minute. Whistle, game, history, funeral, thanks for coming. Run to Chile Sunday. Except not so fast. Apparently we are not on to Chile Sunday. Not so fast, U.S. Women's National Team. Talking head, hot take, Outrage Nation would like to have a word with you first about sportsmanship. It seems scoring 13 goals on a bad team while having a really good time doing it is not sitting well with everybody. I'll get to my take on that in a moment, but first, let's go north of the border to Canada and check in with the four-person panel on TSN. It's comprised of Kate Burness, Claire Rustad, Kaylin Kyle, and Diane Matheson. Their unanimous outrage is almost as mind-blowing as a 13-0 beatdown in World Cup play. Check this out.
If you were going to blow away a team, do it with humility. And they did not. Megan Rapinoe has scored countless goals on the international stage. She was celebrating like she had her first. We can understand if it was a first goal, like a Mallory Pugh. But when you're Alex Morgan, too, and you're counting out your goals, it was just unacceptable.
Well, I understand there's a goal differential race in this tournament. I understand they're nervous about drawing Sweden later in the tournament, but this was disgraceful from the United States. I would have hoped they could have won with humility and grace, but celebrating goals 8, 9, 10, the way they were doing is really unnecessary.
I'm all about passion. And I think as a Canadian, we would just never, ever think of doing something like that. We played against the Americans before where you have a player of Christine Sinclair scoring 3 goals and she would never even think about counting how many goals she has on one hand. For me, it's disrespectful. It's disgraceful. I just, hats off to Thailand for holding their head high. I mean, their first time on a World Cup stage. I'd love to be there to just hug them all.
Yeah, the U.S. is fully capable of blowing out teams. And, of course, in the World Cup, you're not going to hold back. And maybe they have an internal target they want to meet or trying to break the record. But, I mean, it embarrassed is the word for Jill Ellis, I think, the way she was leading her team in this one.
Damn, Canada. Check out the Royal Mounted Fun Police. Way up there on their high horses. Hey, if you're scoring at home, did you jot down any of those words? Quote, unacceptable. Disgraceful, unnecessary, disrespectful, disgraceful again, and embarrassing. All of those adjectives, strong adjectives, in about 90 seconds time.
It was just unacceptable.
This was disgraceful from the United States. Really unnecessary.
It's disrespectful. It's disgraceful.
Embarrassed is the word for Jill Ellis, I think, the way she was leading her team in this one.
I don't know. I mean, agree to really disagree here? We're talking about the freaking World Cup. I guess I'm going to have to educate y'all on soccer again. We're talking about the World Cup, not some AYSO jamboree. There aren't parent tunnels. There aren't orange slices out here. There's no Capri Sun. No matter how badly you want it, this is the highest level of international competition. It comes around once every 4 years. It is really hard to find the back of the net, no matter when and where you play. There is no mercy rule. I guess you could argue that you should throttle down. I suppose, maybe, not really. understand this too. Best believe this, Canada and anybody else who wants to take exception to what I'm about to say. If the U.S. women were on the other side of that 13-0 2x4, I would say the same thing. And as for them celebrating after scoring goals, as for Alex Morgan counting out her goals, I've got no issue with this. Play the damn air guitar on your leg if you want to. Go all Brandi Chastain if you need to. I really don't care. Nothing's promised in sports, you know, were they showing them up? Were they disrespecting the game? I think they're having a little fun. They were showing a little bit of emotion. Like I said, you never know when you're going to find the back of the net, especially in the World Cup. And a lot of them only got on the pitch because of that blowout. They may not get that opportunity again. So they were able to not only score, but to score on a big stage. And you don't want somebody to celebrate that. You don't want them to show any emotion. You don't want them to style that goal. No, I think I like what Heather O'Reilly had to say. She played for the U.S. Women's National Team back before. She said there's no better way to show respect to another team than to keep playing your hardest. Damn straight. It's like football. Taking a knee on somebody late is more humiliating than punching it in one more time. I mean that. Taking a knee on somebody, to me, is more degrading than lining it up and finishing the game and playing it. I'm pretty sure Thailand would rather have any team play a full 90 minutes against them than back off and start doling out sympathy hugs, as Kaylin Kyle suggested.
Hats off to Thailand for holding their head high. I mean, their first time on a World Cup stage. I'd love to be there to just hug them all.
You tell me what's more degrading. You tell me what's more humiliating. The U.S. national team playing the game hard until the end, or the U.S. national team and their coach coming over to give them hugs. Like they're 8-year-olds. It's the World Cup, not the world hug. The U.S. women's team is the best squad on the planet. They did something yesterday that had never been done before. And so far, from what I've gathered today, they're not apologizing for it. And nor should they. They don't have to stop playing. They don't have to give out hugs. And they don't have to listen to any of this either. It's not their fault they're awesome. And the opposition wasn't. I'm not going to put all this on Canada, but that broadcast did originate there. I tell you what, why don't you worry about your group stage and we'll worry about ours. And if this comes back to bite the U.S. team in the ass, we will own that too. Just hope that you don't meet us along the way, because the last time the U.S. and Canada went at it, we bageled you in the CONCACAF Cup final. And from the looks of things, the way they're playing, and from what you're saying, I would not be surprised if we're here to do that again, not to hug it out. Notice that whenever these border skirmishes start, I'm usually trying to moderate the entire thing and officiate and not take a side. I'm very good about that. However, when you come flying in here with words like embarrassing, disgraceful, I got to say something. I mean, it is athletic competition at the very highest level. And I have to say something else. Man, it feels good to be a soccer authority. I just love the beautiful game. Always have, always will.
It was just unacceptable. This was disgraceful from the United States. Really unnecessary.
It's disrespectful. It's disgraceful.
Embarrassed is the word for Jill Ellis, I think, the way she was leading her team in this one.
Wow. Bitter much? Take it easy.
World Cup.
Is there something that is interfering with your happiness or is preventing you from achieving your goals? If so, BetterHelp Online Counseling is there for you. BetterHelp offers licensed professional counselors who are specialized in issues such as depression, stress, anxiety, relationships, grief, self-esteem, and more. Connect with your professional counselor in a safe and private online environment. Anything you share is confidential, and it's so convenient. Get help at your own time and at your own pace. You can schedule secure video or phone sessions, plus chat and text with your therapist. If you're not happy with your counselor, you can request a new one at any time time and no additional charge. And best of all, it's a truly affordable option, and you can get 10% off your first month by going to betterhelp.com/Rome. So why not get started right now? Go to betterhelp.com/Rome, simply fill out a questionnaire, and then get matched up with a counselor that you will love. Once again, do this, betterhelp.com/Rome. Harrison Smith is my guest. Harrison, good to have you on. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me on, Jim.
Good to have you. Listen, the team started 3 days of mandatory minicamp practices yesterday. How has the offseason been for you? How would you describe the mood among the players as you get ready for the 2019 season?
Offseason's been going well. We're bringing back a lot of guys on defense and getting a new offense rolling. So it's good to go against those guys, and they've been coming up with some good stuff for us.
All right, so one of the guys who came back is linebacker Anthony Barr. It looked like he was on his way to the Jets, but then he decides to re-sign with you guys. What's it mean to have him back, and what's it say about him that he was willing to leave money on the table to stay with you?
Yeah, you know, I think it's tough, obviously, to make that decision, and I don't want to speak for him, but I know when it came down to it, he was going to make a lot of money regardless, and when he really thought about it and the realities of it, he wanted to be here and he wanted to win here. I believe he felt like there was some unfinished business and he just couldn't make that move, and he wanted to come back and play with the boys.
Harrison Smith joining us. And to that point, I mean, you guys are tight. You guys are really good friends. You know it's a business. You know guys have to make business decisions. You're never going to fault anybody for that. But when he decided to come back, how pumped were you personally?
I was pretty pumped because I talked to him a little bit beforehand. And like you said, it's a business. Totally understand that. And I saw the report that he was going there. So I said, congrats. Enjoy it out there. And he said, maybe not yet. And so I was pretty pumped when he said that. Still didn't, I expected it to still go down to the wire as it probably did. But, personally, like I said, he's a great player and he's going to help our team and chase that unfinished business. But, he's also a great friend, so it's always good to have him back.
Minnesota Vikings safety, Harrison Smith, my guest. Listen, I know you're not going to make it about you. But let me take a moment. I want to read you a quote from Bill Belichick. Bill Belichick said this of you. Harrison Smith does a great job with pre-snap disguise. He is one of the best. Smith, Ed Reed, Polamalu, those guys are, I'd say, among the best. He's certainly right there, end quote. Look, I know you're not looking to hype yourself, but what's your reaction when you hear arguably the greatest NFL head coach of all time compare you to guys like Ed Reed and Troy Polamalu?
Well, that was the week leading up to our game. So I kind of took it with a grain of salt. I didn't know if he was kind of setting me up and wanted me to try to disguise a little more because he had something for me. But getting compliments is always great, and coming from, like you said, probably the best coach of all time. It means something, but it's also, he also said pre-snap stuff. So I gotta match up the post snap stuff with those guys as well, because those are two of the greats that I grew up watching and have a ton of respect for, both Ed Reed and Troy Polamalu.
So in terms of pre-snap, again, one of the things that he did praise you is the fact that you're so hard to read on the field before the snap and the way that you time your movements. You've talked in the past about loving the chess match of football. So in your experience, how much of winning the play is about what happens before the ball is snapped?
I don't know exactly how much, and it changes based on each situation, down and distance, who we're playing, stuff like that. But there's definitely that you can definitely gain some advantages there. There's also times where, like, maybe I'm doing a little too much, and you've always got to be able to execute your assignment no matter what you're doing and moving around beforehand. But a lot of times it sets up other guys, and that's what it's about. So I try to do those things and try to learn from Zim and George and Jerry Gray as far as, if I show this, we can get them to do that or think this. So I'm always learning from the coaches.
We're talking to Harrison Smith. Now, the thing is, you become not just one of the faces of that defense, but of the entire team. How much pride do you take then in being a Viking and being a leader on that defense?
Yeah, it's personal for me. It's the only place I've ever played. It's the only place I want to play. It's a place that has never won at all. So I'm very prideful in representing the organization and bringing us to places we haven't been before.
Let me ask you this. When you look at the way the game is played right now and the way rules are changing and how offenses have changed, how different is it then being a safety now versus when you first came into the league? And how much has your approach to the game had to change because of the rule changes?
Yeah, so I came in 2012, and it had kind of started changing a little then. And I remember my rookie year, I got fined like $24,000 in a preseason game.
Wow.
And they didn't, like, you know, they fully upheld it and fined me all that and everything. And I was so mad, and I was like, I'm not changing how I play. I loved watching Sean Taylor, and, you know, everyone talks about Ronnie Lott and those guys and how they used to take people out over the middle. And I wanted to do that. And you still can. It's just, you just have to lower your target, be a little more conscious of where you're striking guys, keeping your head out of things. So then from that point, it's gotten more and more strict, which is good for the safety of both offensive and defensive guys. But definitely just focusing on lowering your target, which isn't always possible. But as long as I found, as long as I'm trying to do it, I normally get, you know, in the ballpark, and you can still have those big hits and impact plays without breaking any rules.
We're talking to Harrison Smith. You mentioned Sean Taylor. I mean, part of this obviously is because he left everybody way too soon, but I'm telling you, I don't know too many guys that were more universally beloved and respected than Sean Taylor. What did you like about him and his game?
I loved him when he was at Miami. I think he was all over the place. He was a safety that was, he wasn't one dimensional. He was blowing people up in the run game. He was getting picks. He was covering guys. He was returning balls to the house. So ever since he was at Miami, I loved watching him play, and then obviously at the Redskins. And I think, you know, I think most safeties in the league today would probably say he was a guy that we all looked up to. And like you said, left us too soon. But watching him play was just so fun, and I still go back and watch his clips every now and then.
That's cool. Minnesota Vikings safety Harrison Smith joining us. Earlier in the offseason, you participated in the third annual Firefighters Challenge. It's hosted by Dennis Leary. First off, how did the invitation come to be, and what were you feeling like when you started the day?
Yeah, it might sound like a random connection, you know, being a Vikings player and going to New York. But Dennis Leary has his foundation. He did the show Rescue Me, and he's got that whole background. And then my cousin, Elaine Hendricks, is an actress, and she's been on a few shows with him, and they've become friends. So she invited me last year, and I couldn't make it, invited me again, and I was like, you know, I got to get out there and check that out. It's kind of once-in-a-lifetime deal. And I wasn't really that nervous just because all the firefighters were so, like, welcoming and reassuring. And, you know, it was a controlled environment, but, you know, we got to go into some buildings. They put some fires in and, you know, work the hose and rappel down, like, five stories, I think. So we got to do some pretty cool stuff. And then really just being around the firefighters and how they interact with one another and how they, you know, they have a great deal of trust in one another, obviously, and, you know, risk it all every day. But they also have, like, a great sense of camaraderie, and I just thought it was a really cool thing to be a part of. I kind of want to bring the Vikings DBs out there sometime and do it all.
I mean, I would imagine there's probably, like, this amazing team concept that these guys have. Like, you already had a lot of respect for firefighters and what they did before that challenge, but you'd be the first to point out that it only scratched the surface. Like, did you learn anything more about firefighters and their jobs than maybe you didn't know before?
Yeah, I did. I learned a lot, whether it was, like, just their day-to-day stuff, like asking them how they eat, sitting in the firehouse. And then when they go into fires, you can't see anything. There's smoke everywhere. You can't even really see the fire, how they rely on one another. And like you said, we just scratched the surface. Like, it's not like we were doing anything crazy because it was all controlled environment. But when they go out there, it's high risk, and they don't know exactly, you know, how the building is structure-wise and things like that. So they really have to count on one another, and it just scratched the surface, but gave me even a higher level of respect for what those men and women do.
So why did you ask them why they eat? Were you trying to see if they eat clean? And what was the answer?
Yeah, I was just curious, like, how they eat. Like, do they have a cafeteria like we do? They said no, like, they have to provide their own food or cook, you know, like, they said basically, you know, there's a couple guys or girls that are good at cooking, and there's a couple that aren't, and they just get to eat. They don't have to cook anything. Maybe clean the dishes. I don't know. I was just curious about their day-to-day lives when they're not in the fires.
For sure. Harrison Smith joining us. That's why I ask. I would be too. Hey, are you watching out of curiosity? We talk about sports being a business. It's business. Are you watching the NBA Finals?
I am.
Right, so what do you, as a pro athlete, when you see Kevin Durant, right, you know he's banged up, and you hear everything that's being said and speculated by a bunch of people who have no idea, they're not in the middle of it. What did you think of him trying to get out there, and you know he's not 100%, and then he's balling out, he's playing lights out, and then goes down the way he did? As a pro athlete, seeing that and knowing what goes into it, what kind of thoughts do you have?
You know, I think, obviously, you get on social media and everyone's saying, you know, a guy sitting out or looking to the off season or whatever. And then you see, I mean, obviously he wanted to be out there playing and put it all on the line. He knew he wasn't 100%, but it's the finals. So I totally understand that. And then, you know, it was no matter who you're rooting for, it was tough for him to see him go down like that. But, I definitely understand wanting to get out there. It's the finals. Like, that's what the whole season is for. And it happens a lot in football. Just, you know, there's a lot of injuries throughout the year. And sometimes you might play in a game where you're like, man, maybe if I didn't play, we would have had a better shot because the guy behind me probably would have been better than me, you know, if I'm not 100%. But it's just a tough call because everyone's a super competitor and wants to make a difference. So a ton of respect for him getting out there. It's just unfortunate how it went down.
He is a four-time, I appreciate your thoughts on that too. He's a four-time Pro Bowler. He is an All-Pro coming off another huge year. More career pick sixes than anybody in team history. Minnesota's going to open up against Atlanta on September 8th. Harrison, great talking to you, man. Great to have you back. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Jim.
Reality show which made an announcement of which NFL team it's going to cover this year, and you will never, ever guess who it is. Wait for it. A little longer, and the Oakland Raiders. Oh, hell no. That just happened. That's a real thing. They are going there. The Raiders are getting their own freaking reality show. Are you serious? Quoting John McEnroe, you cannot be serious. You mean John Gruden, who never turned down a chance to hype John Gruden, is going to allow cameras and microphones into his facility? Who the hell saw that coming? Answer, everybody. Yeah, right. Because they were really going to go with Washington or Frisco or the Giants or the Lions. Sure they weren't. There was no way that they weren't hosting this reality show in Oakland. The most predictable thing ever. This team and this roster were built to appear on reality TV. And not in a good way either. Not in an interesting way either. But in a tired and played out way, like most reality television. It's almost like they found a couple of D-bag reality producers that took over an office in the facility and they started building the roster entirely around hashtag content. But you know me, I'll keep an open mind, right? I'm a glasses half full kind of guy. I will keep an open mind. I always do. I'm smart like that. All right. I'll play along. D-bags, pitch me. What do you got? What is this show? All right, you got Antonio Brown. Antonio Brown turned himself into a reality show to get out of Pittsburgh, and now he's in Oakland, and he's going to team up with Vontaze Burfict, the artist formerly known as the dirtiest player in football. Remember when Burfict drilled Brown when they played against each other? Now they're in the same locker room. Spicy! Now Burfict will have the opportunity to put Mr. Big Chest in the protocol every single day in practice. All right, pretty good start. Solid start. You got my attention. But if that's all you have, that's not enough. What else you got? Oh, the wacky owner with the Kirk Heinrich haircut, except painted red. Oh, and that minivan. And that obsession with P.F. Chang's and the flip phone. That, honestly, that's actually all of it dope. Especially Grandpa's strawberry Heinrich cut. Man, keep the camera on that dude 24/7. and remember to hit that guy with some copper tone. Copper tone, Pops. You're already freckling badly. All right, what else you got? You got Perfect. You got Mr. Big Chest. You got the rich, weird dude with the Heinrich cut. Still not enough to get me to watch. How about that other dude? How about that other dude with the miserable cut who makes those stupid faces, who acts like he invented the game, but whenever one of his decisions blows up in his face, he gets behind the wheel of the team bus and he runs over somebody. That's right, Chunk. Chunk Gruden. That's my guy. What are you doing with him? Yeah, you know what you can do with him? He can beef with his once great quarterback. Oh, bring in Nate Peterman to throw some pick sixes. Then we can see Chunk turn beet red and break stuff. Okay, now we're getting somewhere. Maybe I'll mix this in. Maybe. But the show needs something else, man. It needs a really dangerous dude. That one dude who is really unpredictable. That one guy, every team has one, that one guy who's capable of burning that place right to the ground. Ideas, people. I need ideas. What do you got? What do you got? What do you got?
Burning.
Hey, boss, I got one. How about this? Richie Incognito. Hell yes! Richard Incognito. Wait, wasn't Rich the guy who told police last year that he was, quote, running NSA class level 3 documents? Didn't he say that? And was he not the guy who demanded to have his late father decapitated? And the same guy who allegedly punched a hole in the wall and ripped a security system apart in an incident with his 90-year-old grandmother? Oh, hell yes, I'm here for that. They just dropped a Molotov cocktail right into the proceedings, and look what happened. Look, these dudes never even have to win a game to get my attention. These dudes never even have to play a game to get my attention. Incognito is worth the $30 a month alone to watch this. I mean, if this guy is willing to punch a hole in the wall with his 90-year-old grandmother and tell funeral home workers to cut off his dad's head, what is this guy going to say or do when the offensive line coach questions his technique? Better get your popcorn ready.
Get your popcorn ready.
Get your popcorn ready. The only thing this show is missing is a Steve Carbone spoiler alert. Yo, Stevie, you coming in on the 21st? Think. Stevie, you got to be there now. Except there really are no spoilers for here. You know why that is? Because this show is the most predictable thing ever. The most predictable thing ever. That show, that franchise, the most predictable thing ever. Keeping Up with the Kardashians thinks this show has gotten a little bit stale. Cops looks at this show and says, yeah, maybe you move on. Seriously, how did they ever convince Jon Gruden to allow cameras and microphones to be shoved into his face and at practice? It's almost like this guy's built his brand on over-the-top, mic'd-up segments. Look, I'm not going to say that the show didn't have its day. I'm not going to say that show didn't used to be interesting. I'm not even going to say that that show didn't used to be must-see TV. It was, but that was a long, long time ago. Now it feels old, tired, beaten down. Man, do the humane thing and just put it down once and for all. Just do it. You know what it's like? I hate to say it, but it was like the jungle tour stops back in the day. Biggest thing in the world. Best thing in the world. But then it got to a point where we were just going to the same markets, the same places, because only certain affiliates could pull it off. So I just did the humane thing. I just stopped doing it. And I'm looking always for the right way to bring it back. Same thing with that TV show. Because if you are looking, and if you're looking forward to this, again, the issue is you. The issue is you, not them. Do yourself a favor. Go outside. Go for a walk. Find a hobby. Read a book. Do something. Do anything. Because if you really are looking forward to this, this means you've got nothing better to do. And your life did not turn out the way you had hoped.
And you know,
unless you're that guy, there is no reason to look forward to that. If you are that guy, there is no reason to look forward to that.
And you know,
hi,
Hindsight is 50-50.
Kamar Rocker. Kamar, great to have you on the show. How are you?
Good. How are you, Mr. Rom?
Good. Great to talk to you. So the team is having a send-off and heading to Omaha today. Before we get to your monster game on Saturday night, kind of dial us in. What is the vibe like around the team right now, and how hyped are you to be heading to Omaha?
We're super excited. The locker room's pumped. We're all ready to get there. We had a little hype video come yesterday, and we're ready.
Nice. All right, so go back to Saturday for me. The team was coming off that tough 18-5 loss on Friday. So if you lose on Saturday, your season's over. What was your mindset going into that game?
My goal simply was just to win. I knew the seniors relied a lot on the season. They came back for a reason, and my goal is to win for them, being a freshman on this team.
All right, so the thing is, the game did not get off to a great start. You hit a batter in the first inning. Your head coach, Tim Corbin, said the way you responded to that was a critical moment in the game. How did you make sure that that moment did not get inside your head, maybe rattle you a little bit? How did you refocus as quickly as you did?
Just from previous games. I've seen games where that's happened in big games like that, and I knew I had to come back strong the next couple innings.
All right, now you get late into the game, and I know you talked about the eighth inning being a big moment for you, and I'll get to that, but your breaking ball was really nasty. For example, Patrick Mahomes tweeted, quote, "That man's slider is nasty," end quote. When did you realize that you had something good going with that breaking ball, and how big of a role did it play in that performance?
After I hit that guy, the lefty came up. I threw two, and it was a pretty easy swing and miss on him. And after that inning, my catcher came in and said, "Your breaking ball is really tight tonight." I said, "I don't jinx it." And then from then, it was a good breaking ball all night.
Kamar Rocker is joining us. Hey, look, it's one thing to throw a no-hitter, but that was a no-hitter with 19 strikeouts in a game that was 1-0 going into the eighth. In other words, if you make any mistake at any point, that game can get blown wide open with a single swing. So how'd you stay focused in that situation and to make sure that you got locked in for every single batter? Like, did you shut out the pressure or did you try to embrace it?
There's moments in the game that I did embrace it. I did take a look around the stadium a couple of times, and there's also moments where I was just locked in, trying to get an out.
Now, two outs in the seventh inning, Duke calls a timeout. I mean, theoretically, maybe they want to talk strategy, right? Maybe. Or maybe that was kind of about freezing you and getting you out of your rhythm. It seemed like it fired you up more than anything else. What was your reaction to that timeout, and then how pumped were you to respond by striking out the hitter?
I've seen it happen before, and he did it in a really crucial time where it was really in my face, and I kind of took it as in my face, as you can see from the video, and it just gave me more momentum to strike out that next hitter.
Kamar Rocker is joining us, a no-hitter, 19 strikeouts, and Vanderbilt's getting ready for the College World Series. In the top of the eighth, you get a couple of runs, you take a 1-0 game, you make it a 3-0 lead, but you said the eighth was actually the toughest one to pitch. What was going through your mind in the eighth? How were you able to power through that?
That eighth was the first time I've ever gone eight times up and down. The most I've ever been is seven innings, so that eighth was definitely a new thing for me. The body, from the arms to my just legs in general.
So what do you do with that? I mean, do you will yourself through that? How did you get through that when you had not been there before?
Just focusing every pitch, really. That's really it. I don't know what to tell you.
I hear you. So in the ninth inning, not only did you not look tired, you actually look fresh. You strike out the side. What were you feeling in that inning?
I felt the crowd stand up. I felt the momentum come to me and the adrenaline start going. And the crowd, the fans, my teammates definitely helped me get through that moment.
You know, when you're in that moment, you got the adrenaline, it's one thing. But then you get that final strikeout. You know that you not only kept your season alive, but you made history with arguably the greatest NCAA tournament performance ever. How did you feel coming off the mound? How would you describe that feeling?
When it happened, I was in utter shock. I had no idea what I did. I knew it won the game, and I'm glad it was over. And then after that, they let me talk to the fans and show my face, and I guess that's when it really hit, the next couple days.
Kamar Rocker is joining us. Now, the no-hitter is amazing, but how special was it for you to come through with the team, for the team, when you needed it? You start this conversation off by saying, "I want to do this for the seniors more than anything else. I'm a freshman." What did it mean to come through in that moment when the team needed it so badly?
I was hoping in that moment, with that energy that we had Saturday night, that next Sunday, the team would be able to roll through them. And they did exactly what I thought they'd do.
And after the game, David Price jumped on Twitter. He said, quote, "Wow, with a loss tonight, Vanderbilt season's over. Kamar Rocker decided he would throw a no-hitter and punch out 19. To be able to step up that way as a freshman is inspiring. I tip my hat to you, sir," end quote. It's always been a big David Price house here. What did it mean to get that kind of love and respect from a Vanderbilt legend like Price?
I mean, those guys like Price, also being an African-American, they set the path. for me and other black players, and as well as Vanderbilt players, and just the recognition of him was a huge honor.
Now, a lot of people remember your dad, Tracy Rocker. He was an amazing yep. D lineman at Auburn. He was in Knoxville for the game. He was hosting recruits as part of his job with the Tennessee football staff, but he kept sneaking peeks at his phone and to see what you were doing. The story goes, after the game, you, your mom, and your dad were on the phone until late in the night. What was that conversation like?
He was congratulating me, of course. He did say something key earlier. During the start of the season, I struggled a lot, and he kept me calm with the mental state of mind of just, you're going to peak at the right time, and come to find out, he was right.
He called his shot. Now, when you made that decision about college, what was it about Vanderbilt that made you feel like that was the right place?
Like everyone says, the education, the people, the city, the program Corbin has here is just, it's second to none. There's college baseball, and then there's Vanderbilt baseball, and I think there's a huge difference between those two.
Now, you're a freshman, and you said the season's really about the seniors. You're along for the ride. What do you mean by that, and how would you describe the culture and the chemistry of that team? What's that like?
Each and every day through practice, we sit there and we look at those seven seniors and see what they have to do in sort of us. We follow them, and they've done everything in their power to keep us here and get us here. So it's just us to just stay along for the ride and do what we can to help their role.
He is a starting pitcher with Vanderbilt, a no-hitter with 19 strikeouts against Duke on Saturday. And Vanderbilt plays Louisville on Sunday. That's their first trip to the World Series since 2015. Kumar Rocker, my guest. Kumar, great to have you on, man. Thanks so much. Good luck with it.
Thank you.
Mark in Boston. I also mentioned that he's been calling quite a bit leading up to the event, which I respect. He's back for more. Mark, how are you?
Hey, Jim, man. Thank you so much for the Smack-Off profile. It's actually not why I'm calling. I'm calling for the Slash Off, the day we celebrate a clueless psycho that worked in Buffalo. Not you, Rick. Well, maybe you. Hey, Jim, you know one of the best things about being a Smack Off caller is that when you call, you go to the front of the line. You don't have to wait or on hold. 25 years of the Smack Off. I didn't know back when JT the Brick won it if it had the juice to survive, but I feel like it's been on air as long as The Simpsons. Now, just a memo to you Goldman ticket winners, you're going to have to stick your neck out there and risk the blades of the Smacky Chopper. Otherwise, you may not survive. And if you do call, you got to call hour number one or you might bleed out on hold. I better get out before I get Ron. Knife Radio.
All right, Mark, see you on the 21st. Alvy, there were at least 10 dings in there that you missed for his Slash-Off call. She's got a golden ticket. Mona, how are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Great.
Look, I'm going to be brief. I'm coming off the night shift where I'm an ER nurse and first responder, and this is my RSVP call. You called me dangerous, like Iceman called Maverick. So let's see how dangerous I can be to people like, oh, I don't know, Rick and Buffalo Blow. How you doing? Get off the pot, man. Love your show.
All right, Mona, thanks for calling in. Mona in Knoxville has got a golden ticket. She is dangerous. She literally is dangerous because I have no idea what she's going to say next.
That's right.
Good night now!